Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Yesterday, in an hour-long speech to both his people and the world, Russian President Vladimir Putin recited a distinctly Russian view of the history of Russia and Ukraine, then announced the recognition of two independent states in the whole of two eastern provinces of Ukraine, which are currently divided between Ukrainian government forces and Russian-backed separatist forces. He is then said to have directed Russian military units to move into the territory held by the separatist forces, although Russia is saying at this hour there are no military units in the area for now. But still unknown at the point is whether he will try to claim the whole of the provinces of Donetsk and Luhansk, which will spark a war, or whether he will try to enforce his rhetoric that he used yesterday, which suggested that the whole of Ukraine was inseparable from the Russian state. Last Friday, I spoke with career Ambassador Thomas Shannon, who served as the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. He led bilateral and strategic stability talks with the Russian Federation and worked with the other signees of the Iran nuclear deal to ensure compliance of that deal while it was in force, and has served in a variety of multilateral posts at the State Department. He spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations Friday on the challenges of diplomacy in a contested world. I spoke with him on Friday while he was here. Ambassador Shannon, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rich. It's a pleasure to be here.
Right now, all eyes are on Ukraine and Russia and the latter's military buildup to the north, the east, and the south. We should not forget the amphibious forces that are in the Black Sea. As we speak on Friday, nothing's happened, but tensions seem to be growing. And, of course, throughout the day today, we've seen a series of what the U.S. government is calling false flag operations, car bombs in Donetsk. The leader of the separatist area in eastern Ukraine is urging civilians to leave for Russia. So as we talk about this growing tension, we don't know if Mr. Putin is going to decide to go in or not, but what's his end game in your view?
His end game is to win from the United States and from NATO security guarantees that he believes Russia needs in order to secure Russia's frontier with Western Europe. This has been his goal for quite some time, but he has been largely unsuccessful up to this point, even though he's invaded Georgia and invaded Ukraine and annexed Crimea. But obviously his continuing concern about Ukraine is such that he's decided that now is the moment to try to play his cards and see what he can get from the United States and our partners in NATO.
If you were analyzing this neutrally, what has led him to believe that now is the time to play these cards?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure what it is. In many ways, the United States has been operating, and NATO have been operating, in a dramatically changing global environment, with relative power decreasing over time as the Chinas of the world rise, and really play an important role globally. And I think Russia is looking for a way, first of all, not to be marginalized globally, not to be seen as no longer being a central player in determining what the world is going to look like. In other words, the argument is often that this is the century of the United States and China, and that the U.S. and China will define this century. I think Mr. Putin wants to make sure that's not the case. So this has been brewing for some time. But quite frankly, I think that he views the United States as a country currently that's in a degree of political turmoil and turbulence, that doesn't have a clear direction yet in terms of its political leadership and what its foreign policy could be going deeper into the 21st century. And in the aftermath of Afghanistan, I think he believes that the United States might have lost the stomach for a larger struggle against a determined enemy. And so I think he's decided that now is the time to test.
Do you think that also applies to other Western democracies, the same tensions that are at play in the United States and the same divisions that are at play in the United States seem evident in many of the Western European democracies as well?
This is true, and this is a product of the growth and extension of democracy and the challenges that democracy faces in the 21st century dealing with vastly different kinds of societies and technological landscapes. But that said, where I think Mr. Putin has overshot is that in the process of trying to see what he can gain, what he's done is underscored, first of all, the purpose of NATO, which is to protect Western Europe from Russia. But also, I think he has helped create a new sense of unity and common purpose. We'll see if the political leadership of the United States and our NATO allies can maintain that over time. But I think that Mr. Putin might have, ironically, strengthened the opposition to him in Western Europe and beyond.
We can talk about those security guarantees that Russia feels like they need. Certainly during the Soviet era, that was right up to the divide between West Germany and East Germany. Since the end of the Cold War, NATO has expanded into parts of that security buffer, if you will. What do you think his aims are? Is it basically reclaiming the neutralized areas that used to be part of the Soviet Union?
I don't think it's that expansive at this point, but he's certainly interested in Ukraine. He views Ukraine as almost the cultural heartland of the Russian Federation.
It was the grain. It was the, you know, the heartland of the grain and everything having to do with feeding Russia for
and agriculture,
years.
But also culturally and religiously. Mm. I mean, when the early Christian evangelicals move into the Slavic lands and begin the initial evangelization in the Slavic language, it's in Ukraine they begin, and the Russian Orthodox Church actually, its roots are situated in the Ukraine. And so he sees it as a cultural heartland. But I think more importantly, because it's such a large country and because it projects deep into Central Europe, he sees it as a vital buffer state and one that he cannot allow to fall into the hands of either the European Union or of NATO. And so this is his primary interest and purpose. But that said, the Russians have been very active in the Baltic states, especially in those states where there are significant Russian language communities. And he's also been the Russians have also been very active in the Balkans, especially in Serbia, looking for ways to ensure that NATO can't extend and encircle it. And so Russia is always looking for a number of buffer states that will ensure that its adversaries aren't at Russia's frontier. And this is nothing new to Russia. It's not Soviet. It really comes from Russia's long history. And, you know, in many ways, Vladimir Putin is expressing a security viewpoint that is profoundly Russian.
Mm. Now, if he does move into Ukraine, now, as we speak on Friday, he hasn't. But if he does, doesn't he move that buffer point literally to Ukraine's doorstep?
It depends, again, you know, how he handles it. I mean, in a perfect world, he would not want to have to govern Ukraine. And even though he has, depending on who's counting, 150 to 190,000 troops encircling Ukraine, what we have learned from our own experience in Iraq is that that's not enough to control and govern a country. And so I think what he would prefer to have is a government in Ukraine that would be subservient to him, and that would respect Russian interests before it would respect Western interests.
That was one question I had. You know, if he does move into, say, Donbass or in full invasion, will this be a quick incursion like Georgia, or will it be, let's remove the government that I see as a threat and install a government that's more amenable to my interests and get out, or will he be likely to have to stay?
It's a good question, and like so many issues like this, all plans oftentimes collapse once the fighting starts. And so
we were going to Iraq just to go in, remove the government and leave. Yeah.
And so I think he is being careful in this regard because he wants to make sure he's not biting off more than he can chew at this point in time. I think that in a perfect world, he really would prefer not to have to govern a country like Ukraine. And he would prefer not to do the kind of military strike that would be necessary to really collapse that country, because then he would own it economically also. But at the same time, his military knows that if they're going to be successful, they have to bring a level of force that's going to be dramatic. And so how you balance that is going to be the real question.
The New York Times had an interesting analysis of Putin, and the piece seemed to show that opinion seems to be divided between Mr. Putin as a very strategic 3D thinker devoted to expanding that security sphere, however he can do it, in manageable steps that doesn't have a large cost for Russia. And then the other side is someone who talks about how his isolation over the past 2 years, you know, we saw the famous pictures from the talks with Macron, you know, two ends of a 20-foot table. And the fact that throughout the last 2 years, he has been probably more isolated, even with his own advisors, than most foreign leaders. And that has made him increasingly paranoid and maybe a loose cannon. Do you subscribe to either of those views or something in between?
I don't think he's a loose cannon. It's possible that he's living in an environment that is dominated by his military and his intelligence services. But if he is, it's a world he's constructed for himself because he feels comfortable there and because he thinks that is where Russia has significant leverage and advantage at this point in time. I would say that Vladimir Putin is the best poker player in the world right now, and he knows how to play a bad hand well. Because in many ways, Russia is a declining global power, economically, in terms of its demographics, and economically and the other challenges that it faces. But it still has significant military impact, and it still has an ability to project itself, as it has shown in Syria and Libya and elsewhere. And he's intent on playing that to his advantage and showing that he and Russia cannot be ignored. And it would be a mistake to ignore them.
My guest today is Ambassador Thomas Shannon, a former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, and he's a career ambassador for the U.S. State Department. He's currently a lecturer and visiting professor at Princeton and a senior international policy advisor for the Washington firm of Arnold & Porter. He's a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations Friday, speaking on diplomacy in a contested world. So while the Russian situation is obviously front and center, the world, to borrow a phrase from your talk, seems more contested. When the Biden administration took office, I think a majority of Americans thought that, you know, this sense of tension that we had through the Trump administration would somehow subside. It doesn't seem to have done so. What, in your view, is fueling this contested nature between China, the United States, Russia, the United States, various other regional powers?
It's a great question. And the answer could take quite a while, but the short version is that we've seen a global reordering of sorts. The success of globalization, really the success of the United States in building a global economy that trades everywhere, has really created enormous economic wealth and an economic growth around the world, and has led to a huge shift of wealth from west to east and the rise of major Asian markets, including China. But also India, and the emergence of significant middle classes around the world, whether it be in Nigeria, South Africa, Turkey, Iran, Japan, Mexico, Brazil. And in the process of this economic change, technology has also driven social change and political change and created opportunities for political organization and action that historically would be much harder to accomplish. And while the United States is still, without a doubt, the world's only superpower or hyperpower with an ability to deliver its power anywhere at any time, it no longer has an ability to deliver it everywhere all the time or everywhere that matters all the time. And therefore, the United States is faced with a world in which there are rising regional powers, many of whom have global ambitions, and are prepared to challenge the United States to see what is of value to us and what is not, when we will respond and when we will not respond. And in this environment, the United States is just going to find itself being challenged at different points around the world, sometimes in unexpected fashion, and then having to determine whether we, the United States, are going to address that challenge, whether we're going to look for alliance partners to address that challenge, whether we're going to identify surrogates, or whether we're just going to let stuff happen. And in this environment, we really find that a contestation, or this idea that not just ourselves but many others are constantly maneuvering to try to protect interests and to assure that values are respected, becomes really a major feature of the world that we're in right now.
Let me ask you, that sense of competition, if you take a misstep, all of a sudden all of that global commerce that has helped enable your country to grow is at extreme risk. How do they reconcile those two parts of the equation?
You know, if Henry Kissinger were here, he would say that the great failing of the international system that we have created is that we have built a global economic system and not a global political system, mm-hmm. and that instead we have sovereign states competing with each other politically, economically, and in other ways, but have financial flows and commercial flows that pretend as if that kind of competition doesn't exist. And so, as you say, that kind of commercial flow is at risk. And in fact, I would argue that as United States and our partners and allies try to understand how to maneuver and operate in this contested world, that trying to ensure that this global economy isn't collapsed in some fashion and that we can continue to promote the kind of trade and commerce that has made the United States wealthy and has increased the wealth of the world.
And when you look at who is most at risk, is it these emerging economies and countries with perhaps regional and maybe even global aspirations, or it is the established West who really depends on those countries for, you know, finished materials, for the materials to fund, you know, to use the information economy, increasing their military and, you know, security apparatus as well?
I think everybody's at risk if the global economy collapses in some fashion. And I think COVID has shown just how vulnerable we are, because with the advent of COVID and the pandemic, the tendency has been to close borders and to limit the movement of people and to a certain extent the movement of trade. But in the same time, what has really been highlighted for us are supply chains, especially supply chains related to medical devices and pharmaceutical goods. But as we understand the importance of those goods to our larger national security, we're beginning to re-examine supply chains across our economy and really trying to understand, do we have partners in our supply chains that are reliable, or do we have partners in our supply chains that are really adversaries? And can they use those supply chains against us? And so I really think that much of what has been constructed over the past several decades is being re-examined in an effort to understand how we can preserve what works while at the same time ensuring that we're protecting ourselves.
I want to take another side of this competition that we're talking about. Some have been arguing that there's also a larger choosing up. I think you have talked about realignment as well going on between countries committed to multi-party democracies, which many of them are feeling like their democracies are not in the best of shape at this particular point, and autocratic regimes, as well as democratic regimes with autocratic-leaning leaders. Mm-hmm. Do you subscribe to this? I mean, when you just look at the latest conflict between, potential conflict between, you know, in Ukraine, you see Brasilia's leaders standing with Russia. You see Orban and Turkey's leaders more looking towards Russia than they are to NATO and the United States. You're seeing Saudi Arabia saying, "No, we're not going to increase oil production. We have this relationship with Russia, and we want that to continue."
Mm-hmm. You described a phenomenon in global politics in which the world is kind of splitting between democratic and autocratic or authoritarian government, but there's also middle ground, which I would call hybrid government, which can become democratic or autocratic depending on the circumstances and the moment. And there are oftentimes democracies, they would be called illiberal democracies, in which people are electing leaders, but the leaders are then using political power in ways that we would not associate with democratic governance. And increasingly, what I think is happening here is that societies are demanding of governments outcomes. In other words, they're increasingly focused not so much on the process. In other words, free and fair elections are fine. Protection of human rights are fine. Independent judiciary is fine. And in many cases, important and necessary. But what people want in many parts of the world, especially the parts of the world that are mired in either poverty or inequality, is that they want outcomes that allow them to have better lives. And so they're looking to leadership that can provide it. In this regard, the United States, and President Biden has this in mind, the United States has an opportunity to show that democracy can deliver the goods, that democracy knows how to produce the right kinds of outcomes, and that what we're focused on, or what we should be focused on, is helping countries develop a form of democratic development, which will ensure that the resources and opportunities that come from an economy are actually spread across a society and aren't concentrated, as they oftentimes are in authoritarian, autocratic governments. So this is a big issue, and it's one that the Biden administration has decided to take on in a significant way, which it did with its conference on democracies. and which it will continue to do, especially as we move towards the Summit of the Americas in June in Los Angeles, where the United States will bring together all the democracy of the Western Hemisphere to talk about what comes next in hemispheric cooperation.
Of course, our track record from multi-government organizations and the United States and its own aid programs hasn't always worked out that well in the past. It has benefited cronyism and corruption and the like. What gives you the sense that we can change that?
Well, we're not going to be able to change it by ourselves. We're going to have to do it with partners and with allies. You know, General Jim Mattis, when he was Secretary of Defense, once said that the United States never did anything worthwhile by itself, that what we've done that has really mattered, we've done with partners, and partners who share our values and share our broad commitment. And I really think in many ways this is going to be one of the larger challenges that we're going to face, which is identifying those partners that are prepared to work with us and ensure that working together we can show that democracy can indeed deliver the goods.
My guest today is Ambassador Thomas Shannon. He's a career ambassador for the U.S. Department of State, a former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, and currently a senior international policy advisor at the Washington firm of Arnold and Porter, and visiting professor and lecturer at Princeton. He's a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on diplomacy in a contested world. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. When you talk about, you know, obviously China, Russia, these are the main areas of contention between governments. Where are some of the other areas of concern for the U.S. in the next few years? What do you see?
I would say several. First, North Korea is a country that continues to, I think, generate real concern. In fact, one of the unusual circumstances of the Ukraine crisis is that it has largely overwhelmed the fact that the government of Kim Jong-un has done about 7 ballistic missile tests over the last several months and has shown a capability of launching missiles that could hit U.S. territory, such as Guam, or maybe even beyond on the Pacific coast. This is something he did during the Trump administration to try to win the attention of the United States and set the basis for meetings with President Trump. He has not been able to get the attention yet of the Biden administration, but there's no doubt he's trying to do that. And so this is a problem that's not going to go away as long as we're have significant military presence on the Korean Peninsula.
As much as we're trying to read the tea leaves when it comes to Russia's intentions, I think more people are trying to read the tea leaves when it comes to North Korea, because right now nobody's seeing Kim Jong-il a whole lot. And, you know, weight loss, and I think there's very valid concerns about his health.
There could be, but one of the things I've learned over time is that our access to North Korean society is very limited, and our ability to draw these kinds of conclusions only from photographs that are presented to us and that we really don't know when they were taken or how they were taken is really challenging. All I can say is that independent of leadership change, North Korea has remained on a track of hostility to the South, in other words, hostility towards the Republic of Korea, hostility towards the United States, against which it still believes it's at war. Because remember, the Korean War ends with an armistice, never with a peace deal. So as far as the North is concerned, they're still fighting us. But as we look elsewhere, Iran remains a real concern. And again, lost in the Ukraine crisis is the fact that negotiations are taking place in Vienna between the United States, Iran, and the other members of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear deal. In other words, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, the European Union, Russia, and China, trying to see whether or not the United States can be brought back into the JCPOA and whether or not Iran can be convinced to stop its enrichment of uranium. And the negotiations are really in an endgame right now. And there have been some indications that are hopeful, but we still don't have a deal. And absent a deal, this will almost certainly generate real concern in the United States and especially in Israel that Iran is going to revamp and upgrade its efforts to enrich uranium so it can create a nuclear weapon, and that this could provoke a significant conflict in the Middle East.
I was going to ask you about bright spots. I was thinking of these ongoing negotiations as a bright spot. I think you sort of threw some cold water on it little bit, but because I know it's a very difficult deal. And even if we reach a deal, we certainly don't have bipartisan support for reviving the deal.
And the lack of political support is not just in Washington, it's in Tehran also.
Because
just as there are those in Washington who are opposed to doing a deal with Iran, there are those in Tehran who are opposed to doing a deal with the United States. And so how the governments of these two countries find a way forward in this regard is going to be important. But absent a deal around nuclear enrichment, enrichment of uranium, it will be very hard to do a deal with Iran around ballistic missiles, around Persian Gulf security, around any of the other issues that are important to us and to our partners and allies in the Middle East, especially in the Persian Gulf.
Well, are there bright spots, do you see?
I do, actually. First of all, although we are in a contested world right now, and we are in a world in which there are more than a few countries that would like to see themselves become hegemons in their area or region of the world and would like to be able to project that globally. At the same time, if we can find a way to preserve the peace, if we can find a way to keep our global trading system relatively intact and to ensure that we're able to share the benefits of technological and scientific development, I think that we are on the verge of major scientific and technological breakthroughs that could fundamentally change the quality of life for hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people. And this is one of the reasons why I believe diplomacy is so important right now. The 21st century has an opportunity not to be the 20th century, not to be a century of bloodshed and horror, but actually be a century in which mankind has found a way to learn the lessons of the 20th century and try to ensure that it creates a level of stability and peace that allows for the development of peoples and the effort to address long-term systemic problems. And for instance, we look in the Western Hemisphere. As challenging as the countries of the Americas are when it comes to the ravages of COVID and the really significant development problems they have, there has not been a major war in our hemisphere in a long, long time. And there's a reason for that. It's because of the political structures that have been built, the dialogue that has been built, and the fact that we have been able to lay down a groundwork of common political values and economic understandings and promote regional integration and trade in a way that enhances stability. And so I think we can look for ways to build off that and do it in a fashion that is helpful to the United States but also to the world.
Thank you very much for your time.
No, thank you. I've enjoyed this.
Ambassador Thomas Shannon, former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs and a career ambassador at the U.S. Department of State. I spoke with him on Friday when he was in Tulsa as a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on diplomacy in a contested world. He's currently a lecturer and visiting professor at Princeton University and a senior international policy advisor at the Washington firm of Arnold & Porter. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.